right, everyone. It is Monday. It is February 10th, 2020. It is the day before the New Hampshire primary. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. Producer Ken Barnes is in studio today. And starting today, I am going to begin the show every single day between now and the November election in 2020 with the words of Colonel Vindman. And if you had not been following, the president had Colonel Vindman escorted out of the White House on Friday. All right. Actually, not just him, but him and his brother. So speak about retaliation. And if you check out my Facebook post today on my personal Facebook page, I posted an article by Charlie Pierce. And the title of the article is Trump's ousting of Alexander Vindman proves he's still the petty bag of vengeful rage he was raised to be. Vindman's sense of American justice has been traduced by a pack of cheap thieves. But this is the language you're going to be hearing every single day between now and 2020.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful to my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
All right, everyone. That was the words of Colonel Vindman. You'll be able to say them by rote and by the end of the next couple of weeks because you're going to hear it over and over and over again. I think one of the rallying cries in the 2020 election should be remember Vindman. That should be one of our rallying cries. So
Like the Alamo.
Like the Alamo. Exactly. Like the Alamo. You named it. So this is our Rethink the Week. Right now, I know we're going to ask Ken to sort of tell us what's on his mind. But we have Rick Newman joining us. I'm hoping Dean Spiliotis will be joining us as well from Southern New Hampshire University. I had like three or four people say no to me within the last 12 hours. Not that they weren't scheduled, but this is a crazy, crazy time, everyone. Mm-hmm. I can't even tell you. We're all juggling so much of an insane life. But I suspect that between the three of us or maybe the four of us, there will be way too much to talk about. So I know you always have an opening shot, so go for it, Ken.
Okay, thanks, Arnie. What's on my mind is something that is very troubling to me. It's the way the media seems now in the last week or so, maybe more, to be erasing Elizabeth Warren from coverage. They don't talk about her. It's all about the race between Bernie Sanders and Buttigieg, or it's about Biden dropping out. But in the middle is Elizabeth Warren, who has very sound and well thought out ideas and policy choices. She has a lot of supporters. She got a lot of votes in Iowa, and it doesn't really matter how many one gets in Iowa. You don't drop somebody out of the campaign because of one state's caucus results. And it's reminiscent to me of the Bernie Sanders campaign complaining so much in 2016 about being erased and the media not covering them. And even a month ago, Bernie Sanders is at the near top of the polling everywhere and the rallies and everything, and the media weren't talking about him. It was as if he wasn't running. And now they are doing the same thing to Elizabeth Warren. It's like she's not there. And I just find that immensely frustrating and a challenge to our democracy that people are going to think she's not in the race anymore or she's so far behind.
Or you know, broken like Tulsi, as a candidate.
Yeah, like Tulsi Gabbard. You know, okay, don't talk about her, but Elizabeth Warren is very much in there, and she could very well do better than Pete Buttigieg or Joe Biden.
So I'm going to bring Rick into this conversation right now because I think it's really important. I have covered a lot of these campaigns, and I suspect I know what happened to Elizabeth Warren, and in part why she's not being covered right now. And you can tell me, Rick Newman. Rick Newman is a former state legislator. He's a lobbyist. He's a phenomenal talker and very thoughtful. And we've been living, eating, and sleeping this kind of politics for way too long, Rick. God, do we need a life. But one of the things that really concerns me is that it's not her third place finish in Iowa because it was just such – it was so much chaos there. I think – and in part, maybe it's because the expectation was – I think the expectation always was that Bernie was going to do well. Mm-hmm. The question was whether Mayor Pete was going to be able to organize effectively from the moderate wing because that was the alternative to Bernie. Elizabeth was not the alternative to Bernie. Pete or Amy and Joe were the alternative to Bernie, but nobody else. And then I will be honest with you, on the debate stage the other night, which is where she had a real opportunity, like Amy Klobuchar was able to use, to actually be the comeback queen or female or candidate. And she disappeared on the stage. I don't know about you, Rick, but she literally disappeared in that debate stage. And this was an opportunity, one, to show her political skills, to show that she could, in fact, figure out how to rehabilitate whatever was not being talked about, and that she had a message that would resonate with voters at a time when her presence on the stage needed to be seen. And they gave them lots of time. This was not one of the things I love what they did with that ABC debate, because it wasn't on a time clock. They let people flesh out their ideas. And I think what you saw happen was that Bernie did his same old thing, and Biden was I don't know, not terrible, but rambling.
It
was pretty terrible. And am I wrong here, Rick? Did she kind of disappear on that stage? Because I have nothing memorable that I really remember from her. And yet I can tell you exactly what Amy Klobuchar did. And look what it has done for her campaign and for the numbers that we're now seeing coming out of New Hampshire.
Well, I think you hit it. I mean, I thought Amy did an incredible job on that stage. And it may be not so much that Warren disappeared, but that Amy overtook her, or mm-hmm. Amy just – the shadow of her,
exactly.
It was tough for her to overcome it. I think Klobuchar, whether it was genuine or she was coached well or whatever, I mean, she just did come across.
Yeah, she did.
And like you said, Bernie is Bernie. So we've been watching
no matter
him
where
for
he
four
is,
five
it's
years
like, it's,
now.
It's unbelievable.
It's all the same. I mean,
it's all the same.
And I'm, you can't tell the difference between him or the guy on Saturday Night Live that does him. I mean, they
or 40 years ago.
Right.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So,
I agree.
So Bernie's Bernie. And so he kind of blends into the background. Amy kind of came out. And I think that's what that put Warren. Warren wasn't prepared to shine. Somehow.
You understand, Ken, that the problem is it's – what did I say a couple of months ago? I think she would make a wonderful president, but I question her political skills. I don't think she knows how to pivot when she needs to pivot. I don't think she knows when to punch. And we're talking about, who can take on Donald Trump? I mean, this is the gorilla in the room here. And what you saw the good news about Bernie is that everything – he's always the same, so you can't hurt him. Do you know what I mean? It's not like he's going to change his tune. It's not like and his message is consistent, and he can take a message to Donald Trump, and Donald Trump can take a message to him. Oh, good, here comes Dean Spiliotis. And yet what we saw was, and this is the other thing. I'm going to be saying this, I think, on Democracy Now! Tomorrow. By the way, I'm doing Democracy Now! Tomorrow with Amy Goodman. But I say up until maybe 5 days ago, maybe 8 days ago, 40% to 50% of the electorate was still undecided. That doesn't mean that they hadn't visited every single candidate. They hadn't heard them. It wasn't like they didn't hear Joe Biden or they didn't hear Amy Klobuchar, but they didn't know what to pick. And I'll give you an example, Rick. A very smart guy that you and I know, very smart, and I'm not going to say his name on the air, but trust me, probably the smartest guy in the New Hampshire legislature when we served there. He said to me, "I don't know what to do, Arnie. I'm torn between Warren and Bernie and Pete and Amy." Now, listen to what that is. This is one of the sharpest, smartest guys. First of all, that's not ideology, okay? So clearly his heart or his head is with the more progressive wing. Not sure that that's what's going to carry the day. Obviously, Joe Biden isn't even in the mix. So it was Amy and Pete. And guess what he did last night? He texted me and said, "It's Amy." Okay? But he had four choices up until Thursday of last week.
Well, I don't know if you're talking about, but I did read today in the paper that somebody else, or maybe the same person that we both know, Jim Norman.
Oh, no, it wasn't Jim.
Okay, well, Jim Norman was a former executive counselor, former state representative, and he basically said in the paper today he doesn't know who he's going to vote for, and today's Monday, and he said he probably won't know till he's standing in line. Now, that's pretty unusual when you've got somebody who's like us, who are political animals that have not made up their mind yet. That shows you that this race is very fluid.
But you know, so Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, civic scholar, presidential scholar, he's a regular on this show. You hear him on NHPR. He has a blog called nhpoliticalcapital.com. So Dean, everyone says that debates don't matter, except in this situation, that last debate was absolutely – first of all, it was the best debate, I think, of all of them. And for an undecided person, it was a way to finally sort of weigh the cards in front of you. And then, believe it or not, I, like an idiot, watched the C-SPAN Hunter Club dinner just to see how everyone performed. And once again, Amy was good. But you know what the amazing – did you watch the C-SPAN 100 Club dinner?
No, actually, it was Saturday night.
Oh, Saturday night?
Went out to dinner.
Oh, lucky. Lucky.
So, as exciting as that sounds, I saw a lot of clips of it, and it was, you know, it's been reported.
Well, the amazing thing about that night was that I think that's when Joe Biden finally bit the dust. Because Joe Biden got up in front of thousands of Democrats, thousands, the most activated ones, gave a speech that I couldn't – I needed a GPS, okay? I wasn't sure what he was saying or where he was going. And he also sounded out of touch. And then right after him came Andrew Yang. And first of all, Andrew Yang is sort of a – he's the master of ceremonies. Anyway, he's got a good shtick on the stage. But he talked about stuff that everybody could recognize was happening now in their lives. Mm. I mean, it was almost like he checked every box. Oh, yeah, I got that problem. Oh, yeah, I got that problem. Oh, yeah, I got that problem. And to see them in contrast, it wasn't that it necessarily elevated Yang. It just completely evaporated Joe Biden. Mm. Because not only is he not doing well in his ability to connect with people, but on that important stage, it was so frightening.
Yeah, well, and the other day on the stump, he made a reference. He made a John Wayne reference, and I just imagine all the national journalists who are mainly under the age of 40 were probably all like Googling it to try to figure out who's John Wayne and what did he say. And so there is that element of kind of nostalgia bordering on being out of touch.
Well, but it was also a pretty obnoxious comment.
Yeah, it was not a great choice, but what I keyed on was John Wayne. Okay, it's you know. Going back a ways.
So I was on the set on WGBH on Saturday. You may have seen my post on Facebook. And I'm on with Fergus Cullen, who is the former chairman of the Republican Party, everyone. He's a never Trumper. And obviously he'll be voting for Bill Weld. But I think there may be some family members that are voting for Pete Buttigieg, just to let you know. But he's not, because he's a Republican. But one of the things that he did say was that he was watching Joe Biden's campaign and watching Joe in the last, 48 to 72 hours. And he said he felt like he was watching the movie The Sixth Sense. I mean, it was like – it was just – I'm like, we're all dying on the set. But in a lot of ways, that's kind of how it feels. So as we look at this going in, Rick, to what's going to be happening on Tuesday, I'm going to be doing an interview tomorrow with a professor from UNC. And he looked at the numbers – coming out of Iowa, because even if Iowa was chaotic and we don't know the results because we can't figure out how the hell they did the votes, and I'm really angry at Bernie because he brought up the numbers the other night. I was like, oh, stop going back to Iowa. It's a disaster. But one of the things that we were told was that there was going to be a huge spike in youth participation. And we were, in fact, told that 17-year-olds could participate in Iowa for the first time if they turned 18 by November. And what this UNC professor, who will be coming on with me tomorrow because he'll do the real number crunching, is that while Bernie got, saw a rise of 18 to 24% of all the people that showed up with young people, that was a significant increase in the youth participation. Because the numbers themselves overall were so low, that was like 24% of a small number. So when you look at the number of youth that participated when Barack Obama ran, it was huge. It was bigger than Bernie's. And one of the big things that we keep hearing about is that Bernie is going to deliver, but it turns out, guess what? Young people didn't show up. And they were predicting the highest voter turnout of young people ever in Iowa history, and it didn't happen. And I heard this morning on MSNBC that in New Hampshire, it'll be the highest turnout of young people ever. And I'm almost frightened because if they don't show up here as well, that's a pattern. And it's a really bad pattern of participation.
Well, you know what? I'm just sitting here thinking as you're talking, and I can remember when, you know, Jerry Brown jumped into the race in 1980 with Ted Kennedy and Jimmy Carter, and they talked about Brown was going to bring out this enormous youth vote. It didn't happen. And, you know, who was the Republican that ran? Anderson ran as an independent.
Oh, yes.
Congressman Anderson. Oh. He was going to bring out a bunch of youth to come out and vote, and it didn't happen. And all it seems to me about, you know, that we always talk about that, and it generally tends to be about the same. And I do think it's troubling for Bernie's overall campaign.
Yes, that's my
point.
That
he did not draw out that huge crowd of young voters that he thought he would.
That is my point.
Well, and this is what happened in 2004. You remember with Howard Dean, the Orange Cap Brigade was supposed to be all these young voters who were descending on Iowa and were going to, you know, get organize the youth vote and turn it out, and it didn't happen. You know, if you look at voter turnout among younger voters, I'm not necessarily talking these 17-year-olds or 18-year-olds, but generally younger people in their early 20s, et cetera. If you look over the last 50 years, you basically see three spikes around Vietnam, around the Reagan Revolution, and around Obama in 2008, where youth voting spiked up. Other than that, it's basically consistently pretty low. So I'm not seeing anything this time.
But I thought
I thought with Parkland and the women's march and Greta.
I kept thinking, isn't that the equivalent of Barack Obama? How could that not be?
But the other thing you got to remember here too is this is the first time that we're going to be up against the new law relative to college students who came out big for Obama.
Yeah.
And now you've got this new law.
Voter suppression law.
It is absolutely going to suppress some of that vote because there's mass confusion about whether you can vote or you can't vote if you're a college student. So in those towns like Durham and up around Dartmouth and Henniker and those places, we're going to see that that will likely have some impact on the turnout.
So John Nichols called me over the weekend, you guys, and asked me about the billionaire card. And the billionaire card, especially by Bernie Sanders and to some extent Elizabeth Warren for sure, is being played against two people. The guy that's not in the race, Michael Bloomberg, but we do see his ads. And the guy that's in the race, Mayor Pete. So I saw a tracking poll, and the tracking poll had Pete for the first time.
What do you mean the billionaire card? Steyer.
Well, Steyer, you know, it's interesting.
Well, he's a billionaire.
He's a billionaire in the race.
He says he's polling second in South Carolina, so we'll see.
Well, that's because he's still outspent every month. I mean, every dime has been spent in South Carolina. And Tom Steyer. But more importantly, it's almost like Tom Steyer doesn't exist in this conversation. It's really the billionaires contributing to Mayor Pete and the billionaire named Michael Bloomberg.
Okay.
See what I'm saying?
I meant literally the billionaires in the race. Billionaires connecting with candidates.
Yes, exactly right. And it was a lot. Lot of conversation about billionaires. And of course, with Bloomberg, it almost enhances the conversation. And I'm just wondering, do you think that the billionaire thing is harmful to Democrats who are accepting checks from billionaires? Do you think this is a problem for Mayor Pete? It's obviously a problem for Joe. I mean, it also is Joe Biden. Joe Biden has billionaires as well. But since Joe Biden, again, has sort of disappeared from the conversation, we don't see him as the potential candidate in a sense. Is there an issue for Democrats if they're going to attack Mayor Pete, who is collecting money from billionaires? Tom Steyer is the billionaire. And then, of course, Michael Bloomberg is the, you know, endless checkbook. Is this going to be a problem? Will this resonate with voters?
The answer to that, I think, is complicated and changing over time.
Yeah.
I think people are increasingly comfortable with the idea of hundreds of millions of dollars being spent in these races. I mean, Bloomberg has spent something like $280 million already of his own money. And, you know, particularly for Democrats that I talk to who are very concerned that the RNC is raising truckloads of cash as all of this goes on, you know, they sort of in the back of their mind think, well, you know, Bloomberg's there with his billions as kind of a backstop to take Trump down if necessary. You know, this is an argument I've heard in primary politics for many, many years. But this whole small donor, grassroots, et cetera, has been building for a number of decades. For some people, I think it's problematic. I think for others, they're in the sort of, well, everybody does emote in. You know, Buttigieg's argument has been that he's actually the only non-wealthy individual on the stage. It was kind of an amusing way to turn it back on the others. And even the other day on the stump said, well, you know, Bernie Sanders is actually a wealthy, very wealthy
guy. He sold his book.
Yeah. He sold his book. He's a very wealthy guy, right? He's got like four houses.
I tell you, that was in 2016 was an economic advantage for him.
I just want to say on this billionaire versus billionaire troubling to Democrats. I think, Arnie, if you focus on the general election, I don't know that billionaire Democrat as the nominee or a billionaire supported Buttigieg is going to be a problem when they're running against Donald Trump, who's supported by billionaires and millionaires and purports to be a billionaire. I think that the only thing actually about billionaires that would resonate in the November election would be to have somebody like Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders who says, enough of the billionaires already. Let's have an alternative to that kind of dominance of our political system.
So we may neutralize the billionaire for these two billionaires.
Well, that's been Elizabeth Sanders' argument. Elizabeth Sanders is an academic. Elizabeth Warren.
It's
funny that popped into my head. Elizabeth Warren's argument all along.
Exactly.
So we'll either know or not well before, I think, the general election whether that resonates.
So let me tell you something, Rick. Here's what I've been hearing. I've been hearing that there's a difference between donating, a billionaire donating to a campaign and then being the billionaire that basically self-funds. And the difference is the billionaire that donates to your campaign is looking for something. They're looking for influence. They're looking for access. They're looking for some kind of potential political result or regulatory result or corporate result. But when you're a self-funded billionaire, this is perfect because then the only thing you're obligated to is your own personal checkbook and no one can buy you. The problem is they're buying the election. It is just amazing how people are able to sort of say that's the difference. A Tom Steyer, it's not a problem. I mean, he's a good guy with lots of money. Michael Bloomberg, it's not a problem. He's a good guy with lots of money. It's those people, those billionaires that give to a Buttigieg or give to a Biden. That's the problem. And it's really interesting how we see this split screen on the good billionaire and the bad billionaire. So the self-funded billionaire candidate, not such a problem.
Well, on the off chance that any of them are going to do favors for me, I'm not going to criticize any of the billionaires. But, you know, here's the thing. I think there is a group of people in the Democratic Party that are always worried about where money comes from and are worried about the money in campaigns. That group is probably pretty much attached to either Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders anyway. Pete Buttigieg could take all the money he wants from every billionaire on the planet, and it's not going to make one bit of difference, and it just isn't. And that's been the same. About 20% of the Democrats that really care about it, and the rest of them just say, we're not going to unilaterally disarm.
Well, that's what I said. You don't bring a butter knife to it. I mean, what is that line?
You don't bring a knife to a gunfight.
And the other interesting thing is I haven't seen – I've seen Barack Obama now showing up in lots of ads, okay? The Bloomberg ads, it's all Obama. Elizabeth Warren, it's all Obama. I'm surprised that Mayor –
Can I just tell you? The other night I was watching TV with my wife, and all three Democratic ads were mainly about that person and Obama.
Yes!
Literally, right in a row, one, two, three. Obama, 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 all three of them.
Well, and the one thing I'm surprised Mayor Pete hasn't done is talked about all the billionaires that supported Barack Obama. I mean, that's what I'm waiting for because in a lot of ways – because that's really – right, last comment before we sort of change the subject from the New Hampshire primary, which we'll be talking about all day long on Wednesday. So, Rick, is this the last hurrah for New Hampshire?
Absolutely not. Look at what's going on here. James Pindle and the Boston Globe have been writing the obituary of the New Hampshire primary for years. And look what's happening. I was saying before the show, you know, in past primaries, about this time, like usually around Saturday or Sunday, one or two of the national major candidates had pitched their tents and gone on to South Carolina or Nevada or somewhere else. That didn't happen here. You know, they're all right here. They're all somewhere in a diner right now, in a coffee shop, in a school. They're all campaigning right up until the last vote, as Bill Clinton said, till the last dog dies.
You're so good. You're such a little trooper.
This New Hampshire primary is as alive as it's ever been, and it is not the last hurrah. People that are writing that are just wrong.
Okay, so Dean, do you agree with him?
I think it's going to be challenged. Do I think it's necessarily going to be the end? No. I think a lot of the focus is initially going to be on Iowa, see if they can get rid of Iowa.
I
think New Hampshire
– Iowa's going to get rid of itself.
New Hampshire can do a good job. I think Rick is right. This has been a particularly fluid, dynamic primary.
Right.
If they can get rid of Iowa, New Hampshire looks good by comparison. Maybe it'll be like, you know, New Hampshire, Nevada, and South Carolina.
Well, let me say one thing. I mean, let's start with the flaw of Iowa is the caucus. I mean, so right there, but it's so undemocratic. It is
so – unrepresentative.
It's unrepresentative. It's undemocratic.
We got most of the state votes.
Right, right, exactly. So I think Iowa, by definition, caucuses by definition are flawed, and then Iowa blew it up. Okay, so it was like nuclear waste.
Yes.
But here's the problem, Rick, is that Iowa and New Hampshire have always been like a married couple. And the problem is, I don't know if this is a divorce.
They're about to get divorced.
Oh, well, here's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking if they're going to mix it up, everyone is going to say, you can't start with a 90% white, rich state that has the second oldest demographic in the United States. And if we're going to get rid of Iowa, we're going to get rid of New Hampshire. I will bet you now $10 on the air.
That's what they're going to try. The question is whether New Hampshire can decouple.
Okay. Just remember, old, rich, white. Old, rich, and white. Just remember that. And on that note, we're going to go to a break. This is The Attitude with Artie Artisan. It is Rethink the Week. A little labor history is next.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1971. That was the day that's known in Great Britain as the Battle of Saltley Gate. 30,000 Birmingham engineers had walked out in solidarity with a strike held by the National Union of Mine Workers. The miners were taking a stand against austerity pay. The Saltley Coking Works had become the epicenter in the national labor struggle. During the labor dispute, the miners' union and the government had agreed that coal would only go to priority customers like hospitals. But Saltley defied the agreement and kept their gates open. A long line of trucks formed to enter the depot. The workers knew that if Saltley continued to operate, it would undermine their strike. The call went out for a mass action to close the gates. Between 10 and 15,000 working people answered the call. The Evening Mail described the scene with a front-page story, writing, "Below trade union banners, a sea of faces stretched for as far as the eye could see. And there was a great roar as the gates shut for the first time since picketing began last week." Faced with such a crowd, security workers from the depot were forced to close the gate. The crowd erupted with a cheer. Arthur Scarhill, president of the Miners Union, climbed onto a roof to address the crowd, declaring, "If working people are united, they can achieve anything." The victory was a turning point. A little over a week later, the government had agreed to a pay raise for the miners.
A solid wall are we, close the gates, our strength is unity, close the gates. We marched across the years through hunger, doubt and fears. We are the engineers, close the gates, we
like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In hospitals, schools, and homes, people depend on nurses and listen to their advice.
For 17 years in a row, we've been the Gallup poll's most trusted profession.
That's Phyllis Eide, Associate Professor of Nursing at Washington State University. She says nurses are well-positioned to help people understand how climate change threatens their health. For example, the risk of heat stroke and asthma will grow as the climate warms. She says nurses can also encourage patients to take precautions.
How can you help your clients understand where they can go for resources, whether it's a cooling center, whether it's information on how, if they're low income, maybe there are organizations that can help them climate-proof their homes?
But to share information, nurses first need to be fully informed. So Eide says nursing schools should include climate change in their curriculums. She says the profession has a responsibility to educate patients and push for programs to protect public health. For example, nurses can advocate for cooling centers and programs to check on the elderly during weather emergencies.
That's part of our identity as a profession, to really advocate for those vulnerable people.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Thank you. you vote, y'all. Well, on every election day. The one that you vote for, God knows the man may let you die.
Oh my God, be careful how you vote. All right, this is the Attitude with Artie Arnes and Ken Barnes, Pixar Music. So who sings that depressing song? Oh, my Lord.
It's the great Sunnyland Slim, and I think it's still good advice. Be careful how you vote. The man you vote for, or woman, may let you down.
Exactly. Joining us in studio is Rick Newman, former state legislator, current lobbyist. Also with us is Dean Spiliotis, a civic scholar and presidential scholar at Southern New Hampshire University. Before we leave kind of New Hampshire and get into things like Romney and impeachment and Vindman and all the other stuff that's happening in the world that's actually important, coronavirus, I have to mention, Rick, that Donald Trump is showing up in Manchester and New Hampshire tonight. And he is showing up at what is it? The SNHU
arena. It was the old Verizon Wireless arena, right
downtown. It is the biggest arena in the state. And let me just do a little geography lesson for everyone. So not only are they shutting down the largest, basically the largest city in the state in order to accommodate this huge
event.
Right? This is just going to be – I mean, this is our performance artist in chief is showing up in New Hampshire. I'm actually doing CNN tonight, and that's how I'm going to refer to him, as the performance artist in chief and liar in chief. And he'll be on, you know, he'll be on steroids. But where that venue is that right across the street from that is where all the media organize in order to do their uplinks and their interviews with all the candidates. And in a way, it's almost like stepping on them as well, because he knows exactly where they are. He knows that people won't be able to get to them because they're shutting down everything right around hotel.
They're going to have to carry their equipment in. No pulling up and unloading your camera equipment.
Exactly. and it's so interesting to kind of see what he does, because it's not only like that he wants to undermine what's going on, but the location itself literally makes it almost impossible.
The center of the primary really is kind of the beating heart of the primary. The convention center, the big Hilton Hotel there used to be the Radisson, Memorial Park, where they do all their stand-ups, and the arena. It's all right in the center of the city.
The geography is genius, but it's just amazing. So what I want to say, and it's really interesting.
Very clever.
So as a result, I am doing – you ready for this? They're sending me to Goffstown, to St. A's, to do an uplink.
Right.
So I'm actually going outside of Manchester in order to accommodate CNN, because God forbid they figure they can't get me there. Otherwise, I have to be there at 11 o'clock this morning. So has any president stalked a party like this? Because that's exactly what he plans on doing. He plans on holding some kind of
trolling.
He's going to troll.
The youngsters call it trolling.
All right, well, I call it stalking. But has any presidential president, not presidential candidate, but president, done anything like this, Rick?
Well, I don't recall it. I mean, usually people kind of, you know, it's like when the conventions are going on, people fire out press releases of Republicans, but they, you know, the presidential nominee for the Republicans leave the Democrats alone, and the Democrats leave the Republicans alone when they're doing their thing. And, you know, that's been kind of the norm. But that was when we had civility in politics to the degree that we had civility. I mean, we don't have that anymore. And as you said, I mean, Trump learned his trade. I'm telling you, I've watched reruns of The West Wing. And you look at The West Wing, and there are things that come out of that show that come right out of his mouth. He learned about the presidency from television, and he learned how to run for the presidency from television.
Wow.
And this is part of the television. This is a production.
Yeah.
It's more like putting on a show than it is running a campaign. So he steps on the Democrats across the street. That to him is – that's a bigger win than getting votes.
Oh, no.
He would rather do that than get votes tomorrow.
He doesn't want to be president. He wants to be in front of a crowd. This is the stuff that he loves. You know he doesn't read any of the materials they give him. You know he doesn't understand the policy. You know he doesn't know geography. Ask India about China. There's all these things that we know. So when it comes to the effort of governing, that doesn't excite him. It bores him. It's a distraction. It's almost like a little boy saying, Mommy, do I have to do this?
But it's also like he wants to be able to say he won. You know, it's very similar to what he wanted in the Ukraine. He wants the president of Ukraine to tell the media
on beginning an
investigation. I don't care if you actually do an investigation or not. I don't care if the investigation finds anything or not. I want everybody to see the announcement. And he wants to see the announcement. Yes, we all love you so much, Donald, that we reelected you in spite of all you did in these 4 years.
So that's
what he wants.
Let's go back to the things that that happened over the last week. It seems like it's a year ago. They basically walked Colonel Vindman out of the White House with his brother. We know that Mitt Romney had the courage of one and was able to vote for impeachment. We know that at the CPAC meeting where Romney is basically being told not to come, the reason why they're telling him not to come, which is a big conservative confab, is because they're afraid for his safety. For his safety because of this vote. We are seeing Susan Collins from Maine saying, I'm sure he will have learned from this. And, of course, what just happened with Vindman. The ads, Dean Spiliotis, against Susan Collins, is them walking out Colonel Vindman. Every single ad and say, so what did he learn, Susan? He learned that vengeance works. He works at vindictiveness is his calling card. I mean, this is unbelievable. And then you have Lindsey Graham saying that they're going to start investigating the Bidens. And who's producing the material, Dean Spiliotis, but Rudy Giuliani. This is even West Wing wouldn't be so crazy as to do what we've seen just in the last week, because everybody would roll their eyes and say, keep it real a little. Keep it real a little. We are now in totally unreal place.
Well, and it was very interesting to me to hear a number of the senators who voted against removing him from office say that Lamar Alexander said, I would hope he'll learn something from this. And eventually Susan Collins got so much blowback from that comment that she had to say she was speaking aspirationally when she talked about him learning something. And it's pretty clear, you know, anybody who's watched Trump for going back to when he first started running, you know, 5 years ago now, knows that he's not going to change. He believes he was wronged. He thinks he didn't do anything wrong. And so the idea that this is going to somehow have an impact, I think, is kind of naive. In terms of Vindman, you know, president certainly has a right to arrange a National Security Council and his core advisors any way he wants. He can move people in and out. Vindman will be detailed back to the army in some other capacity. But obviously, the way they did it was intended to send a signal.
Of course.
I'm not a lawyer. You know, there's a debate about whether or not it was legal. Sounds like it was legal, if not particularly a nice way of doing it. But yeah, I don't know why anybody would expect that we're going to see anything different.
Well, as the headline Rick from Slate says, Trump's Friday night massacre places him firmly in autocrat territory. And you and I were talking before the show, and to a large extent, I think in some ways he so wants a Coliseum and lions. He so misses that. And I don't want to laugh. Why am I laughing? Because it's terrifying, Rick. This is terrifying. And to see one party, you know, not only support what he does, but then you've got Lindsey Graham saying, we got Giuliani collecting this stuff. Like anything that Giuliani collects isn't toxic waste, Rick.
I don't know. We're in bizarro world when it comes to that stuff. I mean, a United States senator, a chairman of a major committee on television saying it's perfectly fine that a private citizen is out collecting dirt on a political enemy and he's going to lead the investigation. You've got a guy like Lamar Alexander who – different political party than mine, but I always thought that he was a respectable guy and somebody with great integrity. And he says, hey, you know what? I've come to the conclusion that everything the House claims Trump did, he did. I don't think it's worthy of removal from office. So think about that. That to me was the most troubling.
Right.
Susan Collins is Susan Collins.
Yeah.
And as I've said before,
she's a vacant lot.
Always orders the turkey club. I mean, you know, she's after taking a half an hour to decide. But
I like turkey clubs.
But, oh, yeah.
But let's not besmirch the turkey club.
Alexander said the House proved their case, but he didn't think it was worthy of removal. If what the House alleged is not worthy of removal, then nothing is worthy of removal, because what they alleged was that he used the United States security and military money for his own personal gain. If a president can do that and Lamar Alexander thinks that's okay, then we've got a real problem.
But also, hasn't he been successful? So one of the things that we heard over and over again during the impeachment hearing was Hunter Biden, Joe Biden, Hunter Biden, Joe Biden. And while I know that, you know, and people are suggesting that one of the reasons why Joe Biden is not doing well in Iowa, one of the reasons why Joe Biden is not probably going to do well in New Hampshire has to do with the fact that they've now made him somewhat toxic because of the whole Ukraine and Hunter thing, and that the appearance of impropriety for Democrats is hard to swallow given they have a president that defines impropriety. So what I'm trying to figure out is, in a way, God, I didn't want him to run. He's running a bad campaign anyway. This irony of all this is he didn't have to try to take him out. That's the joke, because Joe Biden is not a good candidate. You know, this whole Ukraine thing was because he was afraid of Joe Biden. And Joe Biden proves there was nothing to be afraid of. He's not a good candidate. He's yesterday's story. He's not fast on his feet. He rambles. He doesn't really have what it takes. And yet look at where we are, because Donald Trump assumes, and I'm just trying to figure out, what's the next Ukraine? Who's got the name on it? Will it be the Bernie Sanders Ukraine? Will it be the Bloomberg? What is he going to do next?
Bernie's honeymoon.
And Bernie's honeymoon in Moscow. And it refers to him as a communist. I mean, this is what's so shocking, is that I just keep waiting for what the next event is going to be that would suggest to you, Rick Newman, that we should impeach him. Because right now, unfortunately, nothing is impeachable. So he knows he has a carte blanche.
Well, that's absolutely true. And, you know, Dean said that Trump didn't think he did anything wrong. I'd take that further. I would say, no, I think he knows he did stuff wrong, but he doesn't think it's wrong for him to do it because
exactly.
He's president. He knows it was wrong because he tried to cover it up.
Right.
If he didn't – but he doesn't – he has said over and over, somebody whispered in his ear, hey, the Constitution says a president can do whatever he wants.
Right.
Well, it doesn't, but he believes that, and that's what we've got facing us right now. And that's, you know, that's why Democrats got to stop talking about whether Bernie's a communist or not. And Bernie's got to stop talking about it. And then she's talking about James Carville was absolutely right yesterday when he said we're losing our minds. Stop letting him goat you into talking about these stupid issues and talk to people about health care and jobs and increasing wages.
Right.
And stop getting sucked into debates about who's the socialist or who's the communist.
Yeah, but Amy raised her hand. She said it was a real problem that there was a Democratic socialist at the top of the ticket. She was the only one, which just some extent.
Carville needs to coach all of them. Carville needs to get them all in a room and slap them around. And
all right, so tomorrow we're going to be actually talking about the economy, because one of the professors that were joining us, he listened to the debate, and there was each professor was asked to pull one pull quote from the last debate. And one of them pulled the pull quote from Tom Steyer, who basically said what you said, that it's the economy. So, Dean, how do we get the Democrats to sort of talk about the economy, since what everybody thinks about the economy is the stock market is doing so well, lowest unemployment, blacks are doing so well. Don't you love me, Donald Trump says to the black community, to the Hispanic community, you've got jobs. Don't you love me? You have jobs. And you hear all this stuff, and the headline is accurate. But the details under the headline tell a very, very sort of different story. But how in a campaign do you do the nuance of the economy, which actually reflects people's lives?
Well,
and that's what I think is such a challenge.
But I think I am hearing the outlines of the economic argument among all the candidates. All the Democratic candidates talk about, yes, a small percentage of people in the country are doing incredibly well and the stock market is making them even richer. Big corporations are not paying any taxes. They always mention Amazon as an example, or Facebook. They talk about minimum wage, the idea that there may be a lot of jobs, but they don't pay well, and people are holding on multiple jobs. So I hear I hear that from all the different candidates in slightly different ways, but then we always come back to this sort of larger process argument about how you get there. Is it kind of the big ticket progressive items or a more incremental approach? And so people can't seem to stay off of that aspect of the debate for too long. But the only way you can really approach the economic argument, given how low unemployment is and growth, et cetera, is to talk about not everyone is seeing wage growth, not everyone is seeing security, not everyone has health care, those kinds of arguments.
Well, you know, Rick, we were talking about this last week with Harold Meyerson from the American Prospect, and it turns out that we're beginning to see increases in like the bottom 20% of the economic scale. We're seeing that their wages are going up. And, of course, Donald Trump is taking credit for that because, you know, maybe they have two or three jobs now and maybe that's why their total wages are going up. But you know what's really interesting that Harold pointed out? What Harold pointed out is the number of states that have raised their minimum wage to $10, to $11, to $15. The Californias that have done it, the New Yorks that have done it, the Seattles that have done it, the Chicagos that have done it, the Massachusetts that have done it. And guess who is at the bottom 20% of the economy? It isn't people who actually maybe did well because of a job. They did well because the government forced the employer to raise the minimum wage so that now they could be more gainfully employed at $11 than when they were making $9. And it's very interesting because that's proof that government has a role to play in economic success. It isn't just a job. It's whether you can eat after you get paid from the job, whether you can find an affordable place to live with that job. And that turns out that employers need to be kicked in the pants in order for that to happen.
Well, and you're right. And listening to Trump take credit for people on the low end of the spectrum getting an increase is like him. He takes credit for things that he has. It's like him taking credit for protecting pre-existing conditions while he's suing to take it away.
I know.
I mean, you know, but what gets me in this and all of this debate is the media. I mean, Dean's right. The candidates are talking about these economic issues, and they could talk about them all day long. And then they say they get sucked into one moment of, you know, some debate about whether someone's a communist or whether someone's a socialist or whose kid's got a job because of their famous father. And that's the headline on NBC. That's the headline on ABC.
And
they don't
media.
Talk about the economic.
Oh.
They won't talk about the real issues people talked about. They go right to the sewer that Trump brings them into.
What was amazing for me was there's a story that came out about a week ago, Dean, and they were talking about people that have health insurance, at least on paper, they have health insurance. And then they interviewed people, and this is people at the lower end of the economy, and guess what? They can't use their health insurance. Why? Because they can't afford the deductible.
Yeah.
Because they can't afford the copay. So what we need to know, but this is really important, and yet the media never covers this. The fact that you have insurance on paper makes the assumption that you can go to a doctor, and it turns out more and more people can't access that physician because they can't afford that initial visit because of the cost of that damn visit. I remember many, many years ago, this is an unbelievable story, in Coos County, one of the poorest counties in the state, the nursing homes were county nursing homes, and the nursing homes on paper provided all the employees with health care. Do you know how many of them actually did not purchase the health care that they were in there? Because they were asked to pay half the premium. Half the premium was about half of their paycheck. So they were being told that they had access to health insurance, that the county was going to pay for part of it. But their contribution was half their paycheck. So when you looked at what the generic face was, it said insurance, insurance, insurance. And then when you realize that when it was half their paycheck and nobody was actually using it or acquiring it, you realize that's part of the problem. So we have we can't even discuss it because nobody's doing the math. I mean, in a lot of ways, Andrew Yang is absolutely right. Do the math. And if you do the math, you see how well the 1% is doing, but then you realize how the rest of the 80% are doing, and it just sucks.
Well, my issue with the whole healthcare debate, and I have heard some folks who favor a single payer or Medicare for all.
I don't care.
They do talk about this idea that people have private insurance, but they can't use it.
Right.
So I have heard that out there, but the problem with that debate is it always devolves down into government control versus personal freedom. This kind of larger philosophical debate about, you know, can the government do it better than individuals making their own decisions for their family?
So we kind of lose.
Plus, you know, the talking about the particulars of the healthcare system can be pretty mind numbing.
So when I am actually a slave to my boss. Because my boss tells me everything. My boss tells me what I get paid. My boss tells me when to show up. My boss tells me what doctor to use. I don't have choice. If he changes my insurance policy, well, yes, massa. If he decides that he wants to have us pay more of the premium, well, yes, sir. So this
if he choice, lays you off.
Lays me off, then I'm totally screwed. But I'm just telling you, this idea of choice, even that word is a lie. It is a lie, and the media slips into it because the insurance industry has been using it for 40 years. And then when I ask people, what's your choice?
Well, and the candidates use it too, though, Arnie. There are a number of candidates.
Oh,
the ones who have opposed Medicare for All have said, how are you going to tell the union person that they have to give up their hard, you know, hard-fought negotiations over healthcare, or how are you going to tell somebody who likes their plan? So candidates fall back on that as well, and then, you know, the media kind of is superimposed on top of that.
Well,
the beginning of the process of getting there is to take public health insurance away from members of Congress. I mean, if public health insurance is so damn bad, then why do guys like Lindsey Graham and Mitch McConnell have – Mitch McConnell just broke his shoulder a little while ago, and somehow, some way, the government health insurance plan that he's on fixed it.
Yeah, I know.
If it works for – if it's good enough for Mitch, it's good enough for me.
I think we should all go on the congressional plan. Don't you think so?
Absolutely.
I think that's going to be that's a great campaign. Why are they talking about Medicare for All? Why, we all should be on the
congressional plan.
I want the congressional plan.
Well, I think it's a great strategy because
if you
talk about taking it away from Congress people, you'll see them all screaming and yelling about how they don't want to lose it.
Well, actually, remember, Dean, at one point in time, Congress used to pass laws, but they were exempt from the laws they passed.
Yeah.
And so people don't know this, Dean, until people found out about it and they raised holy hell. And then all of a sudden, Congress had to play by the rules they set for the rest of us peons. And I think the idea of going on the congressional healthcare system would be absolutely hysterical. And what are they going to say? No, I get it, not you.
You should get the same plan that your congressman gets.
Exactly. It would just be amazing. Mm-hmm. All right. Last but not least, I have to touch on this because I'm the climate change baby. I just saw that Georgetown decided to divest from fossil fuels. Now, Georgetown has a very significant portfolio. It turned out that 92% of the students went berserk. And for the first time, this is actually – and now all of a sudden students around the country with all their institutions, I'm hoping like Harvard's and Dartmouth's and some of the, you know, really, you know, deep portfolios are talking about divestment. And you know what makes me smile is that in the 1980s, I wrote the divestment legislation from South Africa for the state of New Hampshire.
I was just going to say, when I was in college in the early 80s, that was a big thing. The colleges were forced to divest from South African investments.
And Rick, here's one of the things I was told that you know, we were supposed to just do what was good for the investments of New Hampshire, and we weren't supposed to look at these details. These were details that weren't supposed to concern us. And at one point in time, a group of older women were in the downstairs in the lunchroom. And they pulled me aside, and I think you may have heard me tell this story. And they said to me, Arnie, have you ever been to South Africa? And I said, well, no, I haven't. And they said, well, we have. And I said, well, that's nice. And they said, do you know what we noticed in South Africa? All those blacks had fat faces. And I went to them, okay, what does that mean? This is 1985. And they said, they're well fed. 1985. And so I said, oh, my God, we need to change our license plate from live free or die to eat or die. All right? That was 1985. I just want to have you understand, the challenges of these kinds of fights are so enormous when you look at it. But I did want to mention that Georgetown was successful, and I'm hoping that this becomes some kind of a snowball effect, that you're going to begin to see this happening all over the country. And then I'm going to end with one more thing, and that is, Rick, if Iowa loses the caucus, we may not have to worry about ethanol anymore. Because all those biofuels, the biofuels are not actually very efficient or effective or climate change, you know, successful, but they sucked up to Iowa. And in a lot of ways, another reason why I want to get rid of the caucus and Iowa first is that maybe we can, like, get away from the biofuels, because once again, every candidate used to genuflect to that.
And we don't – we won't have to watch candidates eating a pork chop on a stick anymore.
That's
– so, you know, so that's – there's another benefit. Let me say one last thing about the New Hampshire primary. You know, people worry about what will – what happened in Iowa happen here. And I think the Saturday Night Live skit with Bernie saying, I got an idea for an app. It's called No App. No gizmos, no computers,
right,
no et cetera.
Right.
We don't have to worry about that in New Hampshire because Bill Gardner doesn't know anything about apps.
No,
I guarantee
he's like me.
You that.
He's a Luddite.
We're going to get a real count. We're going to get it done right. And we're going to get it done on time.
Well, and the other thing that everyone needs to know is that I was asked by a group of students from St. Olaf, what's the one thing you would like to see changed in 2020? I said – I held up a pencil and I said, I want all elections to be held up with a pencil. And then I saw Bill Gardner basically hold up a pencil and say, here's the integrity of the vote in New Hampshire. It's called a pencil. We don't run it through the internet. We don't have an app. You know, basically it reads the scan that goes through and it can't be hacked and whatever. So it's just so interesting to me that the virtue of what is old is new again. And to a large extent, that may be the success of going into the future for the integrity of the vote. Thank you so much, gentlemen.
Thanks,
it is
Arnie.
Our last rethink the week before the New Hampshire primary. Is it the last? I don't know. How do we end?
And everybody vote tomorrow.
Please, in New Hampshire. And how do we end?
We end with One Small Voice by Carole King.
Very good. Very good.
The emperor's got no clothes on, no clothes that can't be. He's the emperor. Take that child away. Don't let the people hear the words he has to say. One small voice speaking out in honesty, silenced, but not for long. One small voice speaking with the values we were taught. Children, so you walk away and say, isn't he divine? Don't those clothes look fine on me?